Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome, everybody. Eddie Trunk here with you, and it's time for another edition of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday via podcastone.com and iTunes. Thank you so much for downloading, streaming, and checking it out, bringing you interviews each and every week, some commentary, some discussion, and here we are now on the Thursday prior to Christmas. Hope everybody has a very, very Merry Christmas, those that are celebrating this coming Monday. And, man, it's been a hell of a week. It's been a hell of a year. It's going to be a hell of a 2018 because I am just working right till the very end here on 2017. And then right after the new year, literally on New Year's Day, it looks like I'm going to be flying to Florida and getting on a cruise ship on January 2nd to broadcast my volume show from a Moody Blues cruise. Yes, I know some of you may be saying that might appear to be a bit out of my wheelhouse, but respect the Moody Blues and voted for him actually for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which they are now in. And the good folks that produce their cruise, who also do the Monsters of Rock cruise and Cruise to the Edge, which I've been involved in, have offered me an opportunity to be on board. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And I suspect a tad more relaxing than Monsters of Rock is for me. So I'm greatly looking forward to maybe getting a little break on top of doing some radio for a few days, and we'll see how that all goes. So, Eddie Trunk Podcast for this Thursday, and of course Thursday is our post day, will feature an interview with a guy that I've literally known over 30 years, a founding member of the band Anthrax, Scott Ian. We'll get to that interview in just a couple of minutes. Before I do, I want to thank everybody that I met and hung out with in Texas last weekend. I hosted an event at Proof Rooftop Lounge exactly a week ago in Houston. Great venue, really cool spot. As the title would suggest, a rooftop lounge with a great stage and a great setting. And LA Guns played, who are just on fire, sounding great lately. Chips Enough also turned in a great set with Enough's Enough. I want to thank Justin Ellington, all the people at Proof, for having me out. Really, really cool venue. Hope to be back soon. And they're going to be doing some work on it, putting a retractable roof on there. They do free shows, which is cool as well. So that was a lot of fun on Thursday. And then Saturday, this past Saturday, I was in Dallas at the Bomb Factory, another amazing venue, where I had a chance to host a big rock show that had LA Guns and Dokken and Ace Frehley and Dangerous Toys and Graham Bonnet. Enough's Enough as well. Good time there. And another amazing venue. Now, the owner there, Clint, has Bomb Factory, has Trees. He has another new venue he's just opening as well. So he's got a lot of great venues going in Dallas. Had a chance to walk around the Bomb Factory a little bit and check out some of the upper level. Just an amazing place. He's got Judas Priest playing there in April. What a great place to see Priest. Good to see Ace. Hadn't seen him for a little bit. Of course, we're old friends. We had a good chance to catch up. Saw Vinnie Paul there. Got to say hi to him. He was just there as a fan and spectator hanging out. Of course, Vinnie lives in Dallas. Told me new Hell Yeah record is coming soon. And a ton of great fans. So everybody in Houston, everybody in Dallas, thank you. Great weekend. Great final road trip. If you're listening to this on post day, I do have one final appearance, and that'll be tomorrow night, Friday, at Dingbats in Clifton, New Jersey. Every year, myself, Don, and Jim, we do a That Metal Show Christmas gathering. Even though the show has been off the air now a couple of years, we still get together and have the party, and it is still a blast. It really is. So see everybody Friday night at Dingbats if you're in New Jersey, coming out Clifton, New Jersey, for what's always a fun, fun way to get into the holiday spirit. And then as far as radio is concerned, like I said, I'm working pretty much straight through. I'm doing radio shows the week between Christmas and New Year's, live shows on, I'll be doing them Tuesday. Well, Monday's Christmas, so Tuesday through Friday, I'll be doing my live volume show, which you can hear on Sirius XM, channel 106, from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time live, replaying every night 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, and on demand on the Sirius XM app. Many of the interviews you hear on this show originated on that radio show. Maybe some of you guys that don't have Sirius XM getting it for the holidays and joining me. I hope that certainly is the case. You will not regret it, hearing my six shows a week that I produce and do live for Sirius XM, talking rock, doing interviews, playing some music on one of them. So hopefully you guys come on board if you are not already. So yeah, working all of the week between Christmas and New Year's pretty much. And then you've got New Year's and New Year's Eve, and then heading out to, like I said, that cruise for the Moody Blues. And then as we peek into January, I'll be in Orange County, California, the NAMM show, the Hall of Heavy Metal History that I'll be hosting once again. That's an award show. A couple appearances around the big NAMM event that happens there every year. And then from there, two more cruises in February, Cruise to the Edge and Monsters of Rock Cruise, both of which I will be on board broadcasting live on Sirius XM. So it's a very, very, very little downtime for me. Not complaining. Good to be busy. And I'm glad to have all your support for all the various things that I do. Excited looking into next year as well for the premiere of my brand new TV show coming on Access TV called Trunk Fest, covering music festivals. And we'll be shooting more of those coming soon in the new year as well. So great stuff ahead. Great stuff in 2017. Thank you for enjoying it with me. And like I said, giving me all that support. By the way, there is a sale going on in the merch store on eddietrunk.com. A couple more days left, 25% off everything in the store, Trunk Nation shirts and much more. Have a look when you get a chance. Probably too late to get it to you for Christmas, but makes a good gift for a day or two after and you still get that Christmas pricing. While you're on my site, Music News, you can email me through the site, eddie@eddietrunk.com. All my appearances as they come in and are confirmed on the homepage of the website as well. And social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And don't forget, speaking of shopping, if you shop on Amazon, be sure to do it by starting on my page, amazon.com/shop/Eddie Trunk. Items hand selected by me, and go anywhere else from that page on the site to do your shopping. Just always start at amazon.com/shop/Eddie Trunk. Helps us out, and I do appreciate you doing that. The interview right now that you're about to hear is a visit with, as I mentioned, an old friend, Scott Ian, founding member of one of the big four, Anthrax. I've literally known Scott now for over 30 years. I've had unbelievable times and experiences with him all around the world. We kind of grew up together. We really did. And we were all bonded as kids by our love of Kiss. And Scott has a brand new book out, his second. And it's called Access All Areas, Stories from a Hard Rock Life. And unlike Scott's first book, which was an autobiography, this book is really more exactly as the title would suggest, random stories. And the second story in the book is about him seeing Kiss for the first time at the same time I did. Although it was back in 1977, I didn't know Scott at that time, but we went to the same first show 2 days apart. And it's a great story of many that are in his brand new book. So we talk about that book. We talk about some of the stories in it. And I think you'll enjoy the conversation with Scott Ian of Anthrax. He is my guest this week on the Eddie Trunk podcast, which, as always, is produced by Katie Irizarry and available totally free, podcastone.com or iTunes. Let's get a little break in. We'll come back and we'll be joined by Scott Ian this week. Enjoy the conversation coming up. I think you will.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
So here are some useful car tips you might not be aware of. A coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior. Removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. And you can place your key fob to your chin to increase its range. Weird, right? Here's another tip you also might not know about. TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar isn't just for buying new cars. With the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you can enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, users can see what others paid, so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar Certified Dealers. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
We're back, the Eddie Trunk Podcast. My guest this week, Scott Ian of Anthrax. Enjoy. Good to see you, man.
Good. Hey, good to see you. Thank you.
You are here in, you live in Southern California now, and you're visiting New York in ice and snow and cold.
Yeah, we went from fire to literally fire to ice.
Did you, anything by you with the fires? You all right over there?
It was close. We dodged a bullet. The winds cooperated, and we didn't have to evacuate. We were ready, though. Our car was literally packed. I had guitars taken out of my house, and wow. Like we were ready to go. Like our fire insurance and mortgage information, all that crap in the car, and boxes of books and suitcases, and we were ready to go.
What's going on there now? I didn't see anything today. Have things calmed down a little bit? Have they gotten a handle on it? Or
that specific fire, the Skirball fire, which was the one like kind of right in L.A. Yeah, that one. I think that one's pretty much done. The one up in Ventura is the really bad one. I think it's called the Thomas fire.
It's really bad when you're starting to name fires. You know, this fire, that fire. I mean, it's just when there's that many of them that they have different names.
Well, it was like four of them burning at once, kind of surrounding L.A. And for 2 days, it was crazy. I mean, the air was really bad. Our lungs were hurting, and it was this thick fog, and it was snowing ash, and it's just very strange when that happens.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. We'll send in our best to everybody dealing with that. Of course, in California right now, just seeing some of it on the news, it's just surreal and just brutal. We got a lot to talk about, obviously, but you're here to promote a book and all that. But before we do, can you say on the air the story you just told me off the air about the fire?
Oh, I don't know. That was Chris's thing, so I don't know.
But it's funny.
I
don't think it's a bad thing. It's just funny.
Yeah, but it's not. If he wants to tell it, Chris can tell
it. Jericho would definitely tell it.
Yeah, maybe. It's his.
Yeah, all right. We'll leave it at that.
All right.
But there's a funny moment related to let's just, well.
Leave it at that.
Yeah, leave it at that. There's a funny moment.
Chris, if you're listening, call in.
Yeah, he can tell us about it. So you got another book here, man.
Yes.
Access All Areas, your second book, Stories from a Hard Rock Life. Of course, you wrote your first book, I'm the Man, came out how long ago? A few years ago,
couple
right?
years ago, yeah.
How long?
Yeah.
Did you know immediately you wanted to do another book at that point after you did the first one?
I kind of knew as the autobiography was being done, I kind of knew because there were so many stories that I couldn't fit into the framework of an autobiography because, you know, you're kind of telling this, you know, my life story is being told, and then to go off on a 70-page tangent on me playing professional poker for 4 years, it kind of takes you out of the story too much, and then to bring it back in. And so that this book, the new book, has 23 stories that for me just really didn't or weren't going to fit into the just the flow of the autobiography.
That's the thing. When you're writing an autobiography, you have to kind of do it in a linear fashion. You have to kind of go and tell that.
I mean, I guess you don't have to, but, you know.
The good ones are, though.
Yeah, and I just knew I had so many other stories to tell, so I would make notes. I mean, I would literally, like, have these notes in my iPhone that I would go through. It'd say, like, Kirk's Door, you know, like, that would be, oh, yeah, I got to remember to write that story, you know, that crazy story with Metallica, or, you know, just Meet Me Under Ace Frehley, one of the titles of story.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that. Yeah.
In the book, that was, I've had that title forever, you know, as I got to write that story, you know. So once I'm the Man was out, it did well enough to get me a second book, honestly. And they asked me, and I said, yeah, I have an idea. I've got all these great stories. It was a go.
Were you, looking back on the first book, before we talk about this one, were you happy with it in retrospect?
Oh, yeah.
Things you would have liked to have changed, added, taken out? Did you get blowback on anything that you wrote in there? Things you maybe wish you didn't reveal? Anything like that? Or are you good with everything in there?
I'm good with everything. You know, the weird thing, and I mean, you have books out, so you may or may not have been through this, but when you write a book, then the publisher takes your finished copy of it and they send it to their lawyers. And then the lawyers read it, and then the lawyers will make their suggestions on changes they think you should make in order to keep yourself, not being sued, basically. They're like, unless you don't mind possibly getting sued by somebody,
right.
Maybe you should change in this part, you should change this person's name, or maybe you want to say this differently about this experience. So they'll just give you their suggestions. They're not telling you change it. It's just up to you. They're basically letting you know that you're probably going to get sued by so-and-so if you keep their name in the book. And I learned that basically people that aren't in the public eye have an expectation of privacy. So, like, if you say you talk about someone in a story from your past and maybe you talk about something they did, drug use or whatever it may be that they never wanted out there, well, they have an expectation of privacy, and then, of course, they could come after you for that. But if it's someone in the public eye and you're telling a story about, then that it's so weird that that expectation of privacy kind of goes out the window. And so I changed names. It's basically
in the first book.
Yeah, in the first book, there's some names that are changed in there, which, is annoying to me, you know, to have to do that because I'm writing my story. I want to be as honest as I can be.
Right.
I also don't want to then spend the next 10 years of my life paying for some stupid stories I wrote in a book.
Right. Nobody's excited to hear the words, well, you might be sued,
yeah.
But and, you know, changing a word to prevent potentially that happening.
Exactly.
Not so a big deal.
That was something I learned from the experience of the first book, certainly. And I wish I could have just said, you know, screw it. I don't care. But, you know, I'm not in a position to, you know, to have to deal with that forever. So we have enough litigation sometimes in the context of the band, just frivolous lawsuits and whatnot over the years. And even when you win, you lose because you've just spent $40,000 on a lawyer. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
And there's no way to get that back. So it's just something I tried not. I like throwing parties, but the last thing I ever want to do is throw a party and invite a bunch of lawsuits.
Yeah. I mean, and that's something people don't understand too. Is that even if it is frivolous, it still costs money, you know, coming out of your pocket. I'll never forget probably 8-10 years ago. Speaking of leaving names out, I'm going to intentionally leave the name out here. But somebody you and I both know that there was a threat of it's the most ridiculous thing ever, a threat of some sort of suit against me for potentially booking an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Most ridiculous thing. Yes, it's that ridiculous.
Right. Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was one of those things where this person just got off on putting a scare into somebody or just got off on potentially suing them or threatening suits so that they could just get their way.
Sure.
And I was just like, well, it's so baseless and ridiculous. But like, yeah, but they'll do it just to, you know, to take 20, 30 grand out of your pocket to have to fight it. And I'm like, wow, that is really some fucked up shit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I never even thought of
it. There's
people
who just make their livings doing that.
What's been in the history of you and Anthrax? What's been the most frivolous, ridiculous thing? Can you talk about it? Like, did somebody try to sue you?
There's one really recently that I cannot talk about on air, and I'll tell you afterwards. But if you want to go way back to 1988, Anthrax was opening for Ozzy on that tour in the like fall and winter of '88, and if I remember correctly. We did two nights at the Long Beach Arena, like December 30th and 31st of 88. And one of those nights, a fan jumped down from like higher up seats, like hopped over a railing and jumped down to try and get down closer or to the floor or something, right. And broke his leg, broke a bone. And it was weeks after the tour was over. And this guy, like, they sued everybody. They sued Anthrax. They sued Ozzy. They sued the promoter. They sued the arena. They sued Coca-Cola for selling Coca-Cola in the arena. They sue everybody.
Sounds like the Jerky Boys. Sue everybody.
Sue everybody. They literally did, though. And we're like, first of all, it happened during Ozzy's set. You know, so we're like, how are we being sued here? Like, how is this? This is crazy. And even, it's not like Ozzy got on stage and yelled and said, everybody jump down.
Right.
He never said those words to the crowd, but it's what people do. And, you know, this is as far back as 1988. And I think even that ended up costing us about 10 grand because
so you actually
we had
to defend that.
Yeah, you get, you know, whatever it is, you officially get served and you have to hire a lawyer and you have to reply and all that. And great, that was it. It got the case against us got dropped. I don't know if it ever got any further against anyone else. But I mean, just stuff like that. A million years ago, we used artwork from the VHS box of the movie Raging Bull, which had De Niro's face on it, right? And in 94, I think it might have been, we used that image on a backdrop on stage. We also had it on our laminated passes and on our itineraries, our itinerary books that we had on tour. We weren't selling any merch or anything like that with De Niro's image.
Right.
It was just we used it as a backdrop on our laminates. And we got a cease and desist. I forget it. It was from, like, United Artists, I think, who owned that. And fine. So we stopped. We stopped using the backdrop, even though our lawyer replied and says, we're not selling anything. It's just it doesn't matter. And then they came after us for $100,000, even though we weren't making a dime off it. And it turned out the reason they came after us is because a promoter, I believe in L.A., who was promoting the L.A. gig on that tour, used that image in an ad in the paper to advertise the show, and now it became like it was now commercial because it was in the newspaper with that image along with our logo, and we ended up having to settle, and if I remember correctly, that was somewhere around 20 or 30 grand. So that was like a really expensive version of Raging Bull.
Wow, that's amazing. That is, I mean, when the thing happens, like with the guy jumping and going after you, and I know we're getting off on a whole nother thing. We're going to talk about the book in a second, but you can't counter back. Like, you can't, like, because it's so frivolous,
you
can't go back for the damages.
Yeah, well, you can, but most of the time, people don't have a pot to piss in. They're just looking to make a dime somehow. And you can go after it, but if they have nothing and then you're spending more money on your lawyer to go after nothing, you're just spending money. We've had to settle so many things over the years because our lawyer is least honest with us and says it's going to cost you more to pay me than it is to just settle this right now. We know you don't want to give whoever it may be a dime out of principle because you're in the right and you know you're in the right, but it's better to spend $5,000 now than $50,000 later. You know, it just, and that's really what it comes down to most of the time. People know people will settle lawsuits, and it's like, so this is like, should be on a different channel here. We're like,
no, but it's interesting.
People know that bands and companies will, a lot of times, will settle. like, because it's just going to cost them more in the long run to keep something going.
And in all the years, anybody who's ever seen Anthrax live knows that the shows, if you're in that crowd, can be very aggressive, especially in the early years in the clubs, the moshing, the stage diving, all the stuff that went on. When people got banged up back then, did anybody of those people ever try to come after you because they were banged up in the pit?
Not in the early days, no. There was a sense of responsibility in the audience where it was kind of, you knew what you were getting yourself into. I think the first people back in the 80s when the mosh pits really started to get, you know, go from small clubs to the bigger level of shows and kids were stage diving and stuff, I think it was the promoters and the venues that were getting hit first with lawsuits because a lot of people were breaking arms and noses and legs and people were getting landed on by people stage diving and they were getting hurt, so they would sue the venue or... And then that's why barricades went up and stage diving was, you know, they put the kibosh on that pretty quickly because nobody wants to get sued, you know. And you know, we were always pissed off at people who would do that, come to a show, know what they're getting into, get on stage, jump off a stage, hurt themselves, and then turn around and sue the people that, you know, that they supposedly are fans of or respect or... You know, that was always a bummer. And then, of course, it just got completely out of hand. And, they really cracked down on all that stuff. So, it used to happen back then. But not right in the beginning. Not in the early, early days. No, nobody even thought twice about... They would never sue the band or a venue that they loved seeing shows at. Nobody would ever do that.
Yeah. Scott Ian's book is called Access All Areas. We're going to get into some specific stories and more about this book in just a few seconds. Actually, we got to hit a break in a minute. But last thing before we go to break and come back and talk about the book some, what's your take? Because this has been a big topic of discussion on my show over the course of the last few months, because there's always stories about it coming out. Maynard from Perfect Circle and Tool just had people thrown out because they were doing it. The whole cell phones at concerts. I mean, I just went to a show, Troubadour in L.A., Stone Temple Pilots' first show, with their new singer, and they were doing this thing where everybody had to put their phones in these bags. You couldn't use them. And I had the CEO of the company that developed those bags on this show a couple weeks ago.
Someone just told me they saw Dave Chappelle at Radio City. It was the same thing.
Well, it started with comedians. This company, because comedians don't want their material out and people knowing the jokes. It makes sense. But now artists are using it. So this company, Yonder, in the Bay Area, the CEO was on with me a week and a half ago talking about why he developed it. His reason for developing it was actually pretty interesting. It wasn't what I thought it would be. But where's you know, you've been on stages playing your whole life. I mean, this is a thing now. Some people it bothers, some people they don't care, go for it. What's your take?
The only way I really look at it, when I'm on stage, I don't care. I'm not paying attention at all. I'm completely focused on what I'm doing in the context of the show that I'm putting on and just trying to make sure that I'm giving the audience everything that I want to give them. I really am not paying attention at all to what's going on out there. Like, we were just in South America. When kids are shooting road flares up in the middle of the mosh pit, that I can see and it catches my eye and it's on my radar. But anything else going on, really, it's kind of completely off my radar because I'm so focused. As a fan going to shows,
right,
I fucking hate it. I hate it. I think it's the dumbest thing in the world that you're going to a concert and then you're experiencing it through a 2-inch screen or whatever your phone may be now. I think I hate it from a fan point of view, and everyone should put the fucking phones away. And I agree. And I would love to only go to shows where they make people put their phones away. You're taking shitty pictures to post on your Insta, your shitty out of focus photos that nobody cares about, shitty videos that sound terrible, that what you're going to sit home and watch these. Like, I mean, I don't understand. From a fan point of view, I hate it. As a guy in a band, I really don't give a shit.
Right.
So I don't care.
You would never, for your own shows, for Anthrax shows, institute the phone lockup plan because it doesn't bother you. But as a fan going to shows,
exactly,
and it being around you, it bothers
you. I know that kind of sounds like I'm contradicting myself.
Not really. I understand it because if you're on stage performing, you don't give a shit.
I don't give a shit. It doesn't bother me. It's not changing my experience on stage in the band. If somehow it started to change my experience, granted, I see the phones out there. Yes, I'm not completely blind. And I do think people would be better served experiencing the show with their own eyes and ears and not worrying about filming the concert. But I don't care when I'm on stage. But yeah, as a fan, we were at Guns N' Roses at the Forum last week, and there were times where I felt like 10,000 people had phones up in the air taking pictures. It's just like, what are you doing? You're not even paying attention to the band. You're paying attention to what you're doing with your phone. People, they're so addicted to their fucking phones, they can't put it down for 2 minutes.
Yeah, I can see, my take on it is, I can see you want to snap a couple quick pictures throughout the course of a two-hour show, once or twice, take a photo. I get it. That's okay. Even if you want to take 30 seconds of video of a certain moment, I get it. That's okay. But the people that are out there doing it the whole time, shooting the whole show, waving these
it's
things,
so
and
annoying.
Everyone looking around, it's really, 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 really distracting. And people say to me sometimes, they're like, well, we follow you and you send stuff out. Well, yeah, a couple things. First of all, that's kind of my job. I'm the conduit to put this stuff out.
Right.
Secondly, I never do it ever if I'm in a position where I'm blocking or distracting anyone around me.
Right.
I'm fortunate enough that because of what I do, when I go to shows, I'm usually in the wings of a stage,
yeah,
or I'm watching at the soundboard where there's nobody behind me but a wall.
Mm-hmm.
That nobody's being bothered. There's absolutely no impact to anyone around. I'm always cognizant of that.
Sure.
I just saw Alter Bridge the other day in Tulsa, and I got to say, that audience at the Canes Ballroom, and that audience was great. There was like the people around me. I was right on the floor with everybody. A couple people would just go up, take a quick photo or whatever. It was fine. Nobody... But you see these people coming with iPads and shit.
Oh, my God.
What are you doing,
yeah,
man?
It's too much.
Yeah, it really is. I keep saying we're going to talk specifically about the book in a second, and we are. But I'm just realizing also that in 5 minutes, we're going to have to hit another break, and then we'll have a clear hour or a more balanced hour.
Right.
So until then, we'll get specifically into the book in a second. But we should mention, so we don't forget, today a press release came out about a new Anthrax release coming out, For All Kings, live from, was it Sweden? Or?
Glasgow, Scotland.
Scotland.
Kings Among Scotland.
So it's a live concert film, right?
Yes. We shot it last February on our headline run over there. And we picked Glasgow specifically because... Again, like when we shot in Chile a couple of years ago, we did that Chile on Hell show to document that run.
Right.
We always try and pick a place where we know we won't have to worry about the crowd reaction. So we take that anxiety or worry out of the mix. Then we really only have to worry about us not screwing up, you know, on stage or any possible technical issues. And we've just always had amazing shows in Scotland, going back to 86 when we supported Metallica at the Edinburgh Playhouse. And we just have a long, long history with the Scottish fans, and they're a great, great audience. And we figured on that run, that would be the perfect show to shoot.
And the set, did you do Among start to finish? Is that what you did?
We were doing two sets. We kind of looked at it almost like a soccer match, where we played the first half, which was a kind of a set of greatest, whatever, a normal set, like
right,
an hour set, normal hour set of songs throughout every record except for Among the Living. And then we would take a 15-minute break while they reset the stage, because we had different production for both. This was like the biggest thing we've done in a really long time. We had different production for both sets, like real production with staging and lights and smoke and all kinds of crap.
When the time you were doing it, your agent and our mutual friend Mike Montrullo was showing me pictures of it.
Right.
He's like, yeah, look at this. So you actually brought
in... Yeah, and then we'd break 15 minutes, the crew would reset the stage, and then we'd come back out and do Among. But we didn't do it in order, because we kind of quickly found out, working on playing that record, I think at the beginning of the run we were playing it in order, and then we realized that the sequence of the record that works on a record doesn't necessarily work in a live scenario. So we just kind of changed the order of the songs up to make it dynamically work better live. But yeah, we played, you know,
all the
songs, everything.
Because you do play a lot of that record and have for a long time, obviously live, but for you doing that, what were the songs that were maybe the most challenging or that you had the most fun playing that you didn't play in a long time?
Imitation of Life,
yeah.
the last song, 9. Even back in the day, we barely played that song. I don't even think it ever made it through a complete tour back in 87 or 88. Definitely played the least of any song on that record. One World probably being the next one that was the least played, even back in the 80s. So those two for me were the most fun because it almost felt like we were playing new songs. Those are great. Horror of It All, another one, obviously not played nearly as much as songs like Indians and
right.
and whatnot. So getting to play those songs, it's great. Especially for me, Imitation of Life, because we've hardly played that song, and it's a song I would still like to play even if we're not doing Among the Living, you know?
And we were talking about, and we're going to start the conversation about Scott's book with, of course, all our points of reference for when we grew up, and that's Kiss. But we're talking about the cover for this DVD, which is coming out when? When is the Blu-ray DVD coming out?
I think it said April 28th.
So it's a little ways down the line. But the cover is a takeoff on Rock and Roll Over by Kiss.
Yes, we are definitely paying homage to, you know, one of our favorite bands of all time.
But
yes.
You had to get permission for that, or you did, or what
did.
Happened?
Well, out of respect, really, it was kind of like, all right, you know, you could see the artwork now. It's out there online. So you'll see it and say, okay, yeah, I get it. It kind of looks like Rock and Roll Over. That's what we were going for.
With your beard as the Gene's tongue.
My beard is the tongue, yeah. But out of respect, I mean, we've known the guys. We've known Gene and Paul since 1987, and I have an actual friendship with Gene, you know. And I wrote him. I emailed him with the art, and I say, we're asking you permission, you know, if this is cool. And they gave us permission. And it's just another one of those moments. Like, that guy, Gene specifically, has kind of gone above and beyond for me so many times since I've known him in 30 years, like just gone out of his way when he clearly didn't have to for whatever reason, and really just has gone out of his way so many times, and you know, just a heart of gold on that dude.
And it's got to be, you know, you take a, like the statement you just said, if you remove yourself from Scott Ian on December 11th, 2017, and you put yourself in the place of Scott Ian in the first chapter of your new book, that's a pretty surreal statement, what you just said. The Scott Ian that opens your new book, if he were knew he was going to be saying that.
I know, but still, I'm not that far removed. I save every email I get from him. I have an archive of Gene Simmons' emails.
First book, you had a co-writer, John Wiederhorn, right?
Yes.
Did you do this one all yourself?
All myself, yeah.
How'd that go?
It went great.
Yeah?
It's a shit ton of work.
It is.
But, it went great. I did have my moments, you know. I'd get in a great flow, and I'd get a lot of work done over, like, 2-3 weeks. And then all of a sudden, the well just kind of runs dry, and everything's, like, just crap, and anything I was trying to write would suck. And I'd go through periods of that for a couple of weeks. And then all of a sudden, bang, I would, you know. So it was kind of like that on and off for a year until it was done.
Did you write on the road, or did you have
some,
to...
Yeah, all over. I mean, we were on tour a lot over the last 18 months. So, yeah, a lot of it was written in hotel rooms and on tour buses and in dressing rooms. And
so
yeah.
you just would, because the reason why I'm asking this is because, and you have a copy right here. I just had Bruce Dickinson on recently.
Right.
His book just came out. Do you know that Bruce wrote his entire book by himself, and that's a big book, by hand,
I'm sure,
with pen and paper,
while he was fencing with the other hand and flying a plane with his feet. If you told me that, I'd say, of course he was.
Like with a pen, with one of those pens you dip in ink.
Yes,
not even a ballpoint.
Yeah, a quill. Like just on writing on papyrus from ancient Egypt, papyrus scrolls.
Of course he did. Yeah, absolutely. So, the biggest problem, like, you would have time on the road because a lot of times you're traveling, so I'm sure that made it a little bit easier.
Well, touring is hurry up and wait.
Right.
You're at a venue all day or in a hotel room all day sitting around waiting for the show. So I just tried to use that time as constructively as possible, and I did. I was able to do it. I was able to somehow, because generally I can't get anything done on the road other than playing shows because I'm in such a mindset of touring and playing gigs, and it kind of makes it hard to work on anything else. But this was so different to that it would kind of, like, it was like a real great escape for me to sit in a room and spend 4 hours writing with just headphones on, listening to music, and spend like 4 hours working on stories, and then like show up at the venue and be so excited like to get out of that zone, and now I get to go on stage, and it actually it made the days go much faster.
Yeah, see, the biggest problem for me with books is, as you mentioned before, I put out two, but both of those books are just like more photos and stories. I'm actually have the last couple of years have been writing my story,
right?
Like 35 years in this business, and I'm like half through it, but the difference is when I did my first two books, I had a deal for them in advance, a publishing deal,
sure.
Right? So my editor gave me hard deadlines where it forced me to have to deliver certain stuff by certain times. This one I'm writing first and then going to see who wants to put it out.
Right.
So I have nobody cracking the whip.
And it makes
it made it so difficult for me to commit to sitting down,
sure,
and doing it. Even if I'm on a plane and I'm like, well, now would be a good time to knock out a couple hours. Like, this movie's on. I'd rather throw the headphones on. I just can't.
Yeah.
I can't find the focus.
Even with deadlines looming, sometimes it's hard.
I know.
My deadline on this book got moved 3 times because I just wasn't done. I felt like I wasn't ready yet. The book wasn't ready yet, and they were super cool about that. It was supposed to come out. This was supposed to come out originally, I think, back in the spring of this year. But I was like, no. It's not ready yet. Needs a little more time in the oven.
So the book is out finally tomorrow. I want to go through a couple things in here and a few stories in this book, because when you and I were texting about this book coming out, you had said to me the first or second chapter was going to be one I was going to be able to completely connect,
yes,
to. But before we get to that one, the opening chapter is called Bald of Confusion.
Bald of Confusion, yes.
You care to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well,
with the audience?
It's a play on the song title, Ball of Confusion.
Right.
But yeah, it's...
Which you covered, by the way.
We
right?
did.
With Joey and John.
Joey and John.
I remember that.
Little known fact in
of course,
Thraxtery.
Yeah, right. that was a... There is an Anthrax song with Joey Belladonna and John Bush on it,
yes,
together, and it's that. It's a cover of Ball of Confusion.
Yes, and it's actually quite good.
Greater of the Two Evils, right? Wasn't that the... That was the...
It wasn't on Greater of Two Evils. I think it came out on that Return of the Killer A's or something like that.
Yes, the compilation is the one new track.
Yes. It's hard to find. It's hard to find.
Yeah, that's a historic Anthrax moment.
Yeah. Yeah, the only time ever.
Yeah. Wow, okay. Well, there's your Anthrax fun fact for the day. Something tells me you're not going to do an interview for this book with anybody else who's going to call
I
that.
I know, exactly.
My God, I'm such a geek. But anyway, Bald of Confusion. What's
yeah,
the story
it's
there?
Just kind of the I
sets things up a little.
Yeah, the Bald of Confusion thing was kind of a bit I was doing in my live talking shows where I would come on stage and introduce myself to the audience and basically saying I understand, you all know who I am. You wouldn't be here sitting here in an audience at a Scott Ian talking show if you didn't know who I was. But then I get into this whole thing on how over the years, my many years being in a band, I've been confused for many, many other people in other bands, including guys in my own band. You know, I talk about it, how I can't tell you how many times I get asked, right today it'll probably happen, aren't you the singer of Anthrax?
Right.
Aren't you the bass player of Anthrax? And now look, I understand... People just get confused, especially the casual listener who's not like online reading, you know, metal sites every day. Just people who've seen me on TV maybe, and they assume I'm the singer because I must be the front man.
Let's be honest, though. You are the most identifiable guy in the band. And I don't mean that with any disrespect to anybody in the band, because
I get it.
You're all great friends. But you have over the years, you became the face of the band.
No, I get it. I talk about it. I'm extremely recognizable with the... I've got this stubbly egg for a head, and the beard's coming off my chin. And
but you are extremely recognizable, but you are also the guy that the journalists and everybody, you're the voice of the band,
yes,
for the most part, and you're on the most of the magazine covers and the photos, and it's just the way the cookie crumbles.
Of
it's
course.
Like that with every band. Every band has one or two guys.
I know.
You
well,
know.
I talk about it in the story, and let's be clear. I mean, Joey and Frankie both have long, flowing locks, and... I do not. So it's just always funny to me. You know, I sometimes just can't be that simple and just answer the question. I have to take it deeper. And that's what the Ball of Confusion thing is all about. I also tell some stories in that story about friends of mine in other bands who have beards. I get into the whole beard thing and how people feel like they just have the right to get their hands up in your beard if you have one. People will walk
that's
up to you in the street.
That's bizarre to me. I read that and I found that bizarre. Yeah, like that would not be something I would even consider doing.
At least some
somebody.
People will ask. They'll say, "Hey man, can I dudes, hey man.
That's fucked up.
Hey man, can I grab your beard?" No. And then they kind of get weird that you say no. Like they had an expectation that you were going I'm going to stand there and let some dude run his fingers
I
through
would
my beard.
Never ever even think
no,
of that.
No, me neither.
Like, Billy Gibbons was here a week
I know.
Ago.
Did you want to?
On this show, I never in a minute had the inclination to want to reach over and touch his beard.
Just kind of run your fingers
and
through his
luxurious beard.
And
that's the architect of rock beards.
Of course. So I talk about Kerry and Zach in my story, and you should read it. It's pretty funny.
Well, because that's the other thing, too. When you say pretty funny, I mean, you have a great sense of humor about all this stuff. There's some really funny things. Like I'm just like, as far as... Let me read this to you from Scott's book. It says, Zach Wilde with his all-father Odin beard wins when it comes to beards. His beard is like a rope that they used to tie cruise ships to the dock. It's truly the king of beards, and why wouldn't he want to show it off? So if you ever have the chance to hang with Zach, grab onto that bridge cable of a beard and yank it hard. He's a big guy, so you may even want to use two hands to pull on it so he feels it.
And then I go on to say, I think there's maybe an asterisk.
By the way,
yes.
This is top secret, behind the scenes info that we'll keep just between us, okay? I wouldn't want this to get out there publicly, and then everyone will be all over those guys even worse than they are now.
Yeah, but I also go on to say, I'm only kidding. Do not pull Zach's beard. Never touch Zach's beard because he will pound you into the floor like a nail.
And he's really all bulked up now, so forget about it. He's on more roids than ever, so look out. The other thing, the next chapter in the book, the headline of the chapter, the title, is Meet Me Under Ace Frehley.
Yes.
Now, I immediately knew what that meant because I grew up here like you did.
Right.
And I met my friends under Ace Frehley.
Yep.
Countless times.
Sure.
I was devastated the day I went to Madison Square Garden and found out that Meet Me Under Ace Frehley had been replaced by Billy Joel at a piano.
Yeah.
It gutted me that day. That was a day that I will never, ever forget. But since we have a national broadcast here and there's probably plenty of people listening that have never been to Madison Square Garden in the late 70s, explain Meet Me Under Ace Frehley.
In front of Madison Square Garden, right off of 7th Avenue, was the entrance to Penn Station, one of the big train stations here in New York, and where the escalators would go down. And
Still like that.
And on the side of this entrance, because it was also right at the entrance of Madison Square Garden, so on the side of this entrance, they had these big photos, these kind of giant framed photos of artists or acts that had performed. Like, I'm pretty sure at the time there was Ace Frehley, you know, with the Hulk rat. I believe it was a Mark Weiss shot of him with the smoking guitar. I think there was like Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus maybe was another photo, and I don't remember what the third one was.
It was like circus, each photo.
Maybe hockey or basketball.
Each photo represented the things
that go
the
on.
Garden were known for. So I think it was definitely like a Rangers picture, a Knicks picture.
The circus.
And
Ace Frehley.
There may have even been a boxing picture.
Yeah, there might have been,
And then to represent concerts and the music there, it was a picture of Ace with the smoking guitar.
For us as kids, in the late 70s, was the coolest thing in the world to see the lead guitar player in our favorite band right there on 7th Avenue amongst all that other stuff. Like, it was just... You know, it was so amazing that it was Ace Frehley up there. It was just
the
coolest
thing. I wonder now, thinking about that in retrospect, like if that caused any drama.
Oh, we used to think about that all the time.
With Gene, Paul, and Peter, that instead of a band shot, it was just Ace.
It was just Ace.
I mean, because four guys from New York forever entrenched in the front of Madison Square Garden, and it's one guy, not all four.
Even for me as a kid, and Gene was my favorite guy. Gene was my guy in the band from when I first got into Kiss. I was actually surprised. Like, I'm surprised it's not Gene with the blood or the fire. Maybe that's too much to put out there on 7th Avenue. So they went with Ace because it's still that you got the smoking guitar, so it's showing something really kind of different than just like Jimmy Page standing there. You would have thought maybe it would have been a Zeppelin photo because they had played the Garden so many times. But Kiss is New York
band.
Right.
So we used to meet So what's your story in the book? So tell, pick it up from there. Like, well, basically the chapter is, and I read about, like I said, about half or three quarters of the book, but of course I read that chapter,
right.
And it resonated so much with me because growing up a KISS fan, like coming in from New Jersey on that train,
right.
Coming up, like what it meant to me, but really meeting Under Ace Frehley is just a part of that chapter. The bigger thing is just about how KISS and that moment of getting a ticket,
yeah.
and you going to the record store and waiting for the tickets and getting your first record, how that basically shaped your whole life.
Yeah, I was trying to really give people a visualization of what my life was 1975, 76, 77. You know, like those years, just even before, like kind of pre-KISS, as a kid, and like just what New York City was like on a daily basis for me growing up, and like what I was dealing with. And then KISS came into my life, and it really did change everything for me. It was the first thing. I mean, I was a big sports fan. I was already a Yankees fan at the time, and I was a comic book fan, but KISS was the first thing that I have to say I truly worshipped as a kid, because it just took so much horror, comics, music. It took all of that, and it wrapped it up in, you know, a fiery, bloody box for me. And, it really just hit me in my right in the balls, you know. I fell in love with it, and I really worshipped it. And, you know, and I'm just trying to, at the same time, show a picture of what New York City was like. And as kids, what you had to deal with then as compared to now, as far as even finding out if a concert was coming to your
right.
town, and how it all worked, and waiting in line, and that just that whole experience of 1977 and being 13 years old and going to your first KISS concert without parental supervision,
right.
with just your friends in Manhattan. You know, it's I tried to make it very visual, and you know, almost like you're watching a movie about a bunch of 13, like Stranger Things without the monsters. Stranger Things with Gene Simmons instead of a monster.
But that's exactly what it did for me, because having literally almost had a parallel experience,
right.
reading the book and reading that section of the book, and having had KISS had the same impact on me. I mean, you and I are not unique in that. KISS
right,
had
of course.
A massive influence like
there
that
were
on
10
so
million
many.
Other kids exactly yeah. like us in that moment.
But what you really did with that chapter is you did put everybody in the time and place. Like, I think today it's so easy to think like, oh, how do you get tickets? Well, you go on your computer and you punch them out.
Yeah.
No, you would go to Corvettes or
yeah.
to the record store, and you would talk to that
you
guy working
them.
The Ticketmaster machine, and what popped up on the screen
yep.
today, and then, okay, when are they on sale, and lining up and
mm-hmm.
sleeping out or whatever you'd have to do to get the tickets. That whole sort of communal experience, you're that particular chapter put me back in that time and place.
Cool.
And I remember coming in, I would take the train in from Jersey, and the whole scene on the train, people would have all their beers in the paper
yeah,
bags.
Yeah, and everyone's smoking weed. And we
you'd
were
come
only-
out of that Penn Station, you'd get, for me, I'd come out of Penn Station, I'd go up that escalator, and whoever I was meeting, yes, you'd meet Under Ace. You
yep.
always met Under Ace before, so everybody had, you know, no cell phones, of course, this is your gathering place, you had a meeting spot.
Mm-hmm.
It was meet Under Ace, but even just the sights and the sounds and the smells around the garden, it still comes back to me even this day when I walk by it, because I remember the people selling the bootleg T-shirts.
Yep.
I remember the guys would always yell, two-sided, because they flip both
oh,
sides
yeah.
to well, show
I,
you both
I
sides.
I tell the story in my book how one friend of ours who was with us, we were still down in Penn Station. We hadn't come upstairs yet because we got to the city so early, and it was cold out. It was December of 77, so we were still down in the station. And a bootleg T-shirt guy came up to us and, you know, was just really pushing
yeah,
his
yeah.
shirts on us. And my friend ended up buying one, gives the guy $10. The guy takes off and never comes back. And then my friend, he's like crying, and he wanted to go home. And we couldn't let him leave, because if he went home by himself, all our parents would have killed us, you know. And so we couldn't let him leave. So we all had to chip in a couple of dollars each so he'd be able to buy another shirt
right.
when we got inside, and that we were able to solve that problem. But, yeah, that's what it was like back then. I mean, these guys were just like in – we were a bunch of kids. We didn't know what to do. We were just hoping not to get robbed.
Yeah, and it was a big – like, you're – like I'm 53. Are you – you're right around
– 53.
So
I'll be 54
age.
This month, yeah.
Okay, so – right. So you're a little older, like by 8-9 months. But still, you were allowed, your parents were cool with you going to that show with just your friends.
That was the first, that was my first concert without
parental supervision. So you were what, 12, 13?
I was 13.
13.
Going, I would have been, I was going to be 14 2 weeks after that show.
Because you and I went to, that was my first show as well. But
right.
I went on the 16th, you went on the
14th. I went the first night. I had seen Kiss before, but with my uncle taking us, my brother and I.
Oh, you went to an earlier show?
Yes, we had seen him, I want to say it was either February that year of 77. It was
the
earlier.
The first time they ever played the Garden.
That year, I feel like I saw them at the Coliseum, so I'm not sure when.
Okay.
I can't remember when, but that was with parental supervision, so it was just a completely different experience.
Right, right. Because I came in, and I remember it was my best friend and I and his older sister took us.
Right.
And then 2 years later, Dynasty Tour was the first time I went on my own, was allowed to take the train on my own and
right.
go to the Garden, which was like, you said, it was a big rite of passage.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
like, oh, now we can, freedom, I can always
you're
go
going
to
the city.
Yeah.
Like, that was a big deal back then. You're going to the city.
But technically, you still lived in New York City.
I lived
to
in
come
Queens.
Into Manhattan.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between where I was in Queens and Manhattan.
Right, just, and yeah. I live and have lived my whole life, you know, an hour out of the city. But again, big difference.
Yeah.
I'm in the burbs of Jersey. Big difference getting on that train.
Sure, especially in the 70s.
Yeah.
We're talking about Taxi Driver Manhattan.
Yeah.
Like, from that movie. If you've seen that movie, that's the Manhattan we're talking about. We're not talking about the Manhattan of 2017 for billionaires. We're talking about the Manhattan of the 70s, where it was a fucking dump.
Oh, yeah.
The city was a dump and a dangerous, weird place. And it wasn't... And in a weird way... Probably for a kid, almost maybe safer in a weird way. I know that might sound crazy, but it almost felt like children weren't being targeted then.
Well, yeah, different time. I mean, hey, listen, today I'm on my way in to make my way in, and I'm hearing about a pipe bomb,
yeah.
you know, in Penn Station. Or
I would. I don't think I would ever. If I lived in Queens and my son was 13, there's no way in hell he's getting on a train with his friends and going to the Garden to see a show. Not these days.
Yeah, and I think about that too with two young kids, that they're going to get older and want to do that. I'm like, yeah, okay. That's why I mean, now it's different because we have so many venues. Like now in Jersey, almost everything that plays New York City is going to play Jersey, even
right.
though it's only a few miles away.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't want to deal with the city, and I get that. I don't. So it's a little different. Back then, it was the Garden or bust pretty much.
Right.
Even I don't even think the Meadowlands at that time. The Meadowlands wasn't even
no,
open
not
then.
Yet. Just the Coliseum.
Yeah. So you had the Coliseum and the Garden. That's it. So anyway, yeah. And I wish, like I said, I said earlier, that meeting under Ace thing was such an iconic thing for us. It was such an important thing beyond just as rock fans to know we had representation in Madison Square Garden.
And it was such a too. I touch on this in the story as well about how. Being a 13-year-old Kiss fan and wearing a Kiss shirt to school, and the older kids, and when I say older, I'm talking about the 15 and 16-year-olds who thought Kiss was for babies, and they were, you know, with their Zeppelin shirts or Pink Floyd shirts and Aerosmith shirts. And I liked all those bands, too, but I loved Kiss, and I would literally get beat up. I'd get knocked down and have my books kicked out from under my arm and all kinds of crap all the time because I was a Kiss fan. And me and my friends who were into Kiss at that time, at the age from 12, 13, 14, we took a ton of shit. We were the minority back then for sure.
Oh, God, yeah.
So to have Ace Frehley's photo up was just, it really was. We wore that like a badge of honor. Like, haha, look, I don't see Jimmy Page up there. I love Jimmy Page, but it would be kind of like, yeah, it's Ace Frehley, motherfuckers.
Yeah, yeah, and you're totally right. And people can't relate to that now with what Kiss has become such pop culture and looked at so differently than what it was shortly after that 77
period.
Yeah,
we were the underdogs.
We were, and it's probably the reason why people wonder why Kiss fans are so passionate and so loyal.
Sure.
Because if you went through that...
Mm-hmm. It was years of hazing.
Yeah, if I wasn't, I've said this 1,000 times, if I wasn't 6'2 and a big guy, I would have gotten my ass kicked daily.
Well, I was like 5 foot and weighed about 90 pounds, so I did get my ass kicked.
They threatened it, but they never did it because
right.
I was bigger than most of them. But if I wasn't, I would have absolutely gotten my ass kicked. The last story on Kiss, and we're talking about other stuff in the book. This is a true story. I graduated high school in 1982. I got my first car senior year. It's first year you get to drive, sure. Right? And I was defiant, like I am to this day and have been my whole life. The stuff I like, I couldn't give a shit if other people think it's cool or not.
Exactly.
I couldn't care less. I'm defiant about it. I don't believe in guilty pleasures. If you like it, that's all that should matter. So, man, 81, 82, my last couple years in high school, what is more uncool than Kiss? You're talking Elder, you're talking Unmasked. Uh-huh. And I was still, I didn't care. I wore the shirt. I had the notebook sticker. I was like, you know, they could spit at me. I didn't care. So I get my first car, and I put a Kiss bumper sticker on the car. There was a guy, a kid, who was so appalled that I would have a Kiss bumper sticker on my car that he attempted to hit it with his own car and ram that's what I was dealing with.
Wow.
And ram his car into my back bumper because I had the balls to put a Kiss bumper sticker on there. That's what was going on in Jersey.
Yeah, wow.
It was dark. Yeah. Dark shit.
Think about acting against your own self-interest.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm going to destroy my own car.
Right, he didn't care.
Hate that so much.
Exactly.
Smart guy. What's he up to these days?
I think he's a landscaper. I don't know. I'm going to go hit his trucks when I see him. We got to take a break. We're going to be right back. More with Scotty, and we'll work your calls in as well. A few more stories from the book. Again, the book is out. We're just scratching the surface here. And, of course, Scott and I get going on Kiss. Forget about it. Access All Areas. It is out everywhere tomorrow. Makes a great holiday gift. I'm sure you got some signings and stuff, too, you might want to mention.
Yeah. First one is at Bookends in New Jersey, Ridgewood, New Jersey, tomorrow night. Wednesday, I'm here at the Strand in New York City. And then Thursday night, I'm in Huntington, Long Island, and I'm having a total brain fart right now at the name of the
book review.
I'm going to get the name of it right now so I could mention it.
I've done all three of those on my...
I think it is book review.
Yeah,
yes.
I've done all great stories.
Sorry,
actually.
It's been a crazy week.
Yeah. All right, so let's hit a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with Scotty on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hope you guys have been checking out History's new scripted drama series, Nightfall. Wednesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. It's set in a medieval France that is tangled in politics and conflict. Really cool stuff. One headstrong and courageous Templar knight, Landry, will lead his order of warrior monks on a life or death mission to find the lost Holy Grail. Control the Grail, control the world. Nightfall focuses on themes such as belief, sacrifice, politics, love, power, and revenge. Nightfall goes deep into the clandestine world of this legendary brotherhood of warrior monks to find out who these knights were, how they lived, and what they died believing. You got to check it out. Nightfall. This season takes viewers inside the medieval politics and warfare of the Knights Templar, the most powerful, wealthy, and mysterious military order of the Middle Ages, who were entrusted with protecting Christianity's most precious relics. You do not want to miss it. Be sure to check out Nightfall Wednesdays, 10, 9 Central, only on History.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
The Sam Kinison story I found to be very entertaining as well, and as bizarre as you would expect from a guy from Sam Kinison. I don't want to give all the stories away in the book because obviously you want people to buy it and read them, but just so you can jump around to some of the things. You've got a thing with Kirk Hammett in here. You've got a thing about playing poker on a VH1 Classic tournament where you knew nothing about playing poker.
Right.
I remember that specifically because I was working at VH1 Classic at the time, and I was pissed because I wanted to be the one that went there and did the coverage.
Ah, okay.
And I didn't. They sent the other host, but because it was just all my friends. You know, it was you and Ace, and it would have been great, and I love Vegas like you.
Yeah.
Talking about how much you love Vegas. But there's so many of these stories
in
here.
That weird anomaly of going out and playing that poker tournament with Ace and Dusty Hill and Vinnie Paul and Sully Erna, and I won that, and that turned into like almost a 5-year professional poker career.
Do you still play?
And that's why there's like that story's in two parts in the book, because it was just such a crazy time in my life where I became a professional poker player.
Yeah, and there's also a time in your life, what you talk about in the book, where you almost became a professional doorman at a club.
Yes, exactly.
You worked for a night
as a
doorman.
I did for one night, yes.
Where you actually did, at a trendy club in New York. Because there was a period in your life, which you talked about in your first book as well, where you actually went off the rails a little bit,
yeah.
Right? Like every night out and drinking hard and living hard. And all
most
of
the 90s into the early 2000s, yeah.
Right.
Pretty much.
And you talk about the club scene in New York, and you got caught up in that a little bit, and
yep.
That you actually at one point had a did I forget if you reveal in the book, was it actually Lorne Michaels' kid that you turned away?
No,
it wasn't.
Well, he was BSing the whole time, but yeah, I always found the kind of the hierarchy at the door at some of these clubs to be fascinating. A lot of times I would go to these fancy pants clubs and kind of just hang out because my friends would work the door, and I would hang out and watch this play go down every night of people like doing anything to try and get into these places. And I'd be thinking, like, it's really not that great in there. The drinks are really expensive.
And the thing you talk about is the fact that in your experience, when people would come up and say, I'm on the list, there really was never a list.
There's never a list.
So
no.
So it really was just up to the discretion of whoever's working the door if they wanted to let you in.
Most of the time.
Based on what you looked like, based on your attitude.
They knew you, attitude, yeah, yeah. Are you right? Do you look right for the room? You know, I don't know. You know, all I know is buddies of ours, my friend Dominic and I, Dominic DeLuca.
Sure.
We had friends that worked at a lot of these joints, and it just worked out great for us because we get to hang out and meet all kinds of weird people and generally drink for free, and that's why we were hanging out in these places. If it was other places, I would have been hanging out there, but you know, the sway of free booze in New York City in Manhattan was always a big motivator.
So when you go, like, you talk about Vegas in here a little bit, and I love Vegas to this day. I want to move there someday. And I think about when I go there, and I was thinking about, like, I walk through those casinos now, and the whole club scene and EDM scene and everything that goes on there is massive. And it's nothing really of any interest to me at all. But I look at it from the outside, and sometimes I walk by and I see those lines, people trying to get in, and I see the guys with the computers and the clipboards.
Uh-huh.
Do you think there's really a list there?
Vegas, I'm sure there's probably some kind of a list because you got to figure
rollers.
High rollers are, you know, their name must be somewhere because they're getting into those joints. So I got to assume there's some kind of list at those places.
You're fighting to get into a place where you can get charged like $20 for a beer.
Yeah, you're trying to get in yeah.
for the right to pay
exactly.
for that. You talk about Anthrax being unmarried with children.
Yes.
And the biggest question that you get all the time about that, which is,
did you sleep with Kelly Bundy?
And the answer to that is,
oh, I'm not going to give away the answer.
Well, the answer to that is interesting how you phrase
it. Yeah. See, I talk about it.
I tell
the story because that question is not that simple if you really think about it, because Kelly Bundy doesn't actually exist. So when you think about it that way, it makes that question very strange.
Did you read Sebastian Bach's book?
I have not read his book. I used to hear stories about that way back when.
And I, like you, I've known him and those guys forever, and I never picked up on any of that. Now, he didn't sleep with her.
Right.
At least he swears that in the book.
Uh-huh.
But he did have a relationship with her.
Right. I remember hearing rumors about that like a million years ago.
Up at Skid Row. I mean, the whole thing. He talks about it in detail in his book. So it's nothing.
Cool.
Yeah. So if you want more on Kelly Bundy.
But that's not Kelly Bundy. That's Christina Applegate.
Right. Right. The Kirk Hammett thing, which is... You basically break into Kirk Hammett's house.
Yes.
And jam.
Yeah. Something I still get a little sweaty about because it was such a horrible thing to do to a friend. But, you know, you can't... It was me, Charlie, Frankie, Lars, James, and Kirk had been with us earlier in the night. And we all got pretty tanked up, and we're looking for a place to go play music. And Kirk's house was the closest place at the time.
And the last thing, because there's a million stories in this book. Again, you can get it tomorrow because I'm going to give the rest of the show to you guys on the phone. So we'll take some calls for Scott. The last thing in the book, the last thing I'll ask you about that I read the chapter on, which I had no idea about, is your evening with Madonna.
Right.
Which the funniest thing is that when Madonna answers the door.
Yeah.
Pick it up. She's wearing a see-through shirt.
Like, we get to our apartment, and she's wearing a completely sheer top, so it's literally just boobs right there. And I was a massive fan of hers, still am, and I always thought she was quite attractive. And I was very, very nervous to, like, be meeting her for the first time. And she opens the door, and basically her boobs are just there. And you're trying to be cool and not just stare. And you're trying to make eye contact. And it's like her boobs were talking to me. Like, you can't not look at us. What are you, crazy? Like,
I'm laughing because, do you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yeah.
Did you see the latest episode?
No,
you didn't see the sign language one?
No, no.
Oh, when you watch the episode, basically, I'll watch it. But yeah. there's a very relatable story to what you're talking about.
Cool.
Because they hire somebody to do sign language.
Right.
Who has huge boobs.
Right.
And distracts everybody from what's supposed to be going on, and Larry gets all screwed up over it. That's such a great show. But you went, interestingly enough, you went with Madonna. You knew her because of her, manager.
At the time, Guy Osiri.
Right.
Was running her record label. She had just started Maverick Records, and Guy, who was already a friend of mine, was the guy running Maverick Records.
And you went with him and her to see Rage Against the Machine.
Yes, at the Limelight.
Before they were signed, because everybody was trying to sign them.
Yes, I think it was like a showcase, if I remember correct. I'm not sure, but they were playing the Limelight, and they were trying to get Rage Against the Machine to sign with Maverick, and we went. And I had seen them once before at that point at a small club in L.A., you know, even before that, and had already been blown away by them. And then getting to see them at the Limelight, standing next to Madonna, and I don't know if you remember, there was those little kind of areas above the stage at the Limelight where you could watch from. And I saw a lot of people down in the crowd. They see me up there, and they're like looking at, like, I'm standing next to Madonna. And it was kind of cool because people started chanting Anthrax and stuff like that.
And you're like, yeah, they're not chanting Madonna.
Yeah, exactly. Look at you. Yeah, it's awesome. Like, yeah.
Do you remember what Madonna's take on Rage Against the Machine was?
She thought they were great.
So she wanted to sign them.
Oh,
they didn't end up signing to Maverick, obviously.
They didn't get him, but obviously Guy and Madonna both thought they were great.
Yeah. My biggest memory of me and you at the Limelight was UFO reunion tour.
Oh yeah,
Walk on Water.
Yes,
and the place was packed, and you couldn't see because we're all on the floor. And at one point, you jumped on my back. Like, who the hell's on my back? I turned around, it was you. You're trying to see over everybody. That was an amazing night. I'll never forget that. All right, we got about 20 minutes left, and we're going to finish up with Scott Ian with your calls about anything you want. He's got a plethora of stories in his book, which you can buy tomorrow, called Access All Areas, Scott Ian. And check it out. Just scratching the surface on some of the stories he tells in this book. We'll finish up with you guys on the phones about maybe you got some Anthrax questions. We mentioned that DVD coming out in April. Maybe some new music coming soon or something. Maybe thinking about it a little bit.
Yeah, there's some ideas kicking around. Charlie recently sent some killer riffs. I heard them, and in my opinion, they're awesome. And it makes it very exciting moving forward. You know, I always kind of get a little bit of anxiety after we make a record, and then you go out on tour, and a year goes by, and you start to think, all right, we're going to do this again? And did we use up our quota of riffs? Like, you know, For All Kings is a great record, and where are we at now? And then Charlie sent some riffs over, and I'm like, all right, next record's going to be fucking amazing.
Well, if it continues on the trend of the last couple, Worship Music, For All Kings, unbelievable Anthrax records among, I think, the best
you
ever made. So
thank you.
Hopefully that trend continues. And if Tony Iommi doesn't run out of riffs, you could always call Tony. I mean, he's got a bank of them. You could always borrow a few from him.
There is the Killthrax tour, too. We go out again.
Right. Yeah.
Killthrax 2, the first run with us and Killswitch Engage, it went so well. We're getting a sequel. That starts the end of January. Of course, you can find all those dates at anthrax.com.
All right. Scott Ian sitting in with me right now. His book is out tomorrow. Access All Areas is the name of it. Buy it anywhere you buy books. A great holiday gift as well. Perfect time to release this thing. So that's cool. We'll grab a couple quick calls here before we have to wrap up the show and let Scott get out of here. taking his son to see Big Show tonight here in, on Broadway, right?
Yeah. I guess I won't say the name of it just because it yeah. could be weird.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, we're going to a big Broadway show
There you
tonight.
Go. First for Revel, right?
Yes.
All right. Very cool. Well, you guys have fun in the city. Great time of year here. Let's say hello to Sean, who is in Wyoming. Hey, Sean, what's going on?
Not much. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hey.
Hi.
Scott, I want to tell you, I've seen you guys 100 times, but the most memorable show I've ever seen, and probably the most energetic show I've ever seen in my entire life, was put on. You guys headlined a little tiny club with 200 people in it in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Oh.
On September 12th, 2001.
Yeah, I remember it well. Yeah, the night after 9/11.
Blew that place. Yeah, you guys blew that place apart. It was the energy release we all needed. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, we were in, oh my gosh, I'm totally brain farting on where we were on 9/11 right now. Anyway, we didn't know what to do after 9/11 because we were on a string of shows heading west to meet with Judas Priest in Los Angeles, where we were about to start a run of dates with Judas Priest. And so 9/11 happens, and we're like, well, what do we do? Priest was in Mexico at the time. They couldn't get out. Everything was just, nobody knew what was going on. You mm-hmm. couldn't fly anywhere. You couldn't do anything. So we made the decision, well, let's head west to the next gig, which was in Fort Collins, Colorado. And we got there. And, of course, the promoter said to us, I totally understand if you guys want to cancel tonight, it, you know. And our attitude was, let's play. Anyone who comes out, people need a release tonight. Yeah. They need to be entertained. And we did. We played that show in Fort Collins, and it was crazy. It was a crazy night. And then we all found a way home the next day. Obviously, the rest of the dates were canceled. But that Fort Collins show was really something special.
And then a couple months later, I put together the New York Steel show, which you guys played, which yes. was the anniversary, the 16th anniversary of, which just a couple weeks
right.
ago.
Because we were right in Lincoln, Thanksgiving. We were in Lincoln, Nebraska, actually, on 9/11.
What I remember about that, and I was telling you guys that at the time, was that when I wanted you guys on the bill, and of course you guys wanted to play, and you did end up playing, but I actually got a lot of pressure to not have you guys on,
right,
and I had a fight to have you on because the band was called Anthrax.
Right.
And of course that, for people who have seen photos, you came out on stage in that night, everybody wearing jumpsuits that said, "We are not changing our name."
Right.
People have often asked me what that picture was about and had to put it in context of that time and place. I mean, I actually had the people I was working with on the show saying they should play under a different name. I'm like, no. I mean,
yeah.
It's ridiculous. The whole reason why I wanted to put that show on was because that world of music had been excluded from the benefits and things that were happening. And I was like, we need a release too. We need to
yeah.
have our moment. So that's something that I will never forget happening. Steve in New York. Hey, Steve, you're almost Scott Ian.
Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. Hey, listen, I'm glad that your house was spared here in the fire, but I want to know, what's the fire drill look like at the Ian house? What has to go for guitars, comic books, and books?
Well, obviously, physical safety of, you know, my son, my wife, and I obviously comes first. But I had a bunch of guitars in the house, and Anthrax stores their gear at a place in Los Angeles, like a place that does that. They store bands' stuff. So I did have them come with a van, and I had all the guitars taken out the day before we thought we were going to have to evacuate. And then, it's basically just important paperwork, and it was like a bunch of Stephen King books that I have, and we're going to take a bunch of photos, personal photos and stuff like that. I mean, you can only take so much, you know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, and a couple of suitcases
yeah.
filled with clothes in case you're going to be out for a couple of days.
Yeah, man, that's
horrible. What about your comics? Judge Dredd, Mr. Monster, any of that stuff?
Comics are all in storage. They've been in storage for years.
There you go, Steve. The comics are safe. Thank you for
yes.
calling. Thanks for listening. Steve in Kentucky. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Scott, you're one of my childhood heroes. I was 12 years old when Attack of the Killer Bees came out. My dad bought me a T-shirt. I had a hat. He used to piss off my fifth-grade teacher that I wore it. I was always running around saying, not, not.
And then right on.
I had a cousin, had a boyfriend. He was a real pussy, and he was like, Anthrax sucks. You need to listen to White Line. I was like, no way, Anthrax rules. But anyways, I grew up a big Kiss fan. Know you guys are big Kiss fans. Have you guys ever thought of doing a show in Kiss makeup playing Kiss tunes for like maybe half a show?
In Kiss makeup playing Kiss tunes.
I think Stone Temple Pilots did that. Well, they were in the makeup. I don't know if they were playing Kiss songs, yeah. But they did wear makeup.
I mean, we've covered many Kiss songs throughout our years. And we've even as recently as last summer, we played Chicago Open Air on the day Kiss headlined. And we played Parasite in our set.
You did?
Yeah, knowing that they weren't playing it in their set. But, yeah, and we told those guys, I think we told, like, Gene when we saw him, like, you know, we did Paris. Like, you did? Yeah. But, yeah, and it went over really well, too.
I'm trying to remember. You've done Parasite. You did Watching You,
didn't you? We've done Watching You. We've done, oh, my God, I'm going to forget now. There's more. Love Her All I Can.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's one more. And then we also did the most obscure one, and you could actually find it on YouTube. We covered the song from the Mego Kiss Dolls commercial. Kiss, that's the name, Kiss. That we actually covered that. It's on YouTube somewhere.
It's like 30 seconds long.
Yeah, yeah, we did that song.
Now, who do you have to clear that with?
That was the reason why it never came out on a CD back in the day. Because Gene worked with us on it. They were trying to find out who actually had the rights to that song and that commercial, and nobody could find it, so we ended up not being able to officially release it.
I'd love to know how Gene let that go, that he doesn't own that.
Yeah,
maybe it's going to come out on the vault.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe
for 50 grand, you get an official version of it.
I don't know that they wrote that song.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah,
find a way to. He didn't draw the cover of Rock and Roll Over either. You still had to go to him and ask him.
That's true. That's true.
So yeah, all right. Let's talk to Jeff, who's in Seattle. Hey, Jeff, you're on with Scott Ian.
Hey, Eddie. Hey, Scott. I'm a big fan of the. We've Come For You All record.
Thank you.
A couple of things that I've always enjoyed about it is first hearing Dime's voice every time I play Cadillac Rock Box.
Yeah, yeah, you know? For sure.
Two things I want to ask, and I'm going to hang up and let you answer. What's with the inside joke with the Desmond C. Child? We music lovers know who Desmond Child is, and G Money, I guess you can explain. And also, how did you get Roger Daltrey to sing background vocals on that record? So thanks for everything, and I'll listen to your answer.
The Desmond C. Child and G Money stuff, that was basically what it was called back then, was Dime Bonics. Daryl had all kinds of sayings that made sense to him. and you know, sometimes made sense to, if, you know, if you were in his inner circle, and even if you were in the outer circle. But sometimes those were like nicknames he had for people, and I can't actually tell you what it exactly mean, but it was definitely a Kiss reference, because as most people probably know, Daryl was also a massive Kiss fan.
Sure.
So, yeah, the fact that he would throw around like Desmond Child's name as like a term of endearment for somebody, it's just Dime Bonics. That's the only way I can explain it. And Roger Daltrey, that literally was because of my wife Pearl and her mom, I guess. Your mom knew Roger? And yeah.
Somebody made a call.
Yeah, and we ended up going out to dinner. We had dinner with him a couple of times, and I just couldn't believe I was sitting at dinner with Roger Daltrey, right? And I just got up the nerve to kind of ask him. We were working on the record at the time, and he was like, nobody ever asks me to do anything. Like, I'd like to do more stuff, but nobody asks. I'm like, it's because everyone's afraid.
Because you're Roger Daltrey.
Yeah, because you're in The Who. You're Roger Daltrey.
Right.
And, yeah, so I asked him, and he said yes. It was insane.
Hey, before we go, because we're going to be out of time here in a second, you mentioned Pearl sitting here. And you guys did that Motor Sister record, which I absolutely loved.
Yes.
You want to do that again? You want to do another one?
You never know.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, Pearl's finishing her own record right now. She's finishing a Pearl record. So that's kind of the priority in that world, really, right now, is for her to get that record done and out next year and get out and tour that. But mm-hmm. You never know. Motor Sister could happen again someday.
That's a great record for people that didn't check out that record out. Check that out. It's called Ride. And I loved that record.
Cool.
I love it too. Really good record. And Pearl with a follow-up to, let me get the title, Little Immaculate White Fox.
Yes.
Oh, man, I pulled that out. It's a long title, Pearl. I'm trying to remember. But a follow-up coming soon.
Yes.
All right. Well, we look forward to that as well.
Produced by Jay Rustin, your favorite producer.
Jay is the man. Jay is my favorite. Everything Jay does sounds good to me.
My thanks to Scott Ian of Anthrax. Check out his new book, Access All Areas, which is out right now. Rock and Roll Road Stories, a few of which we just touched on in the conversation you just heard with Scott. Appreciate him coming by. New episode next Thursday, as usual. Free via podcast1.com and iTunes. Have a very Merry Christmas, everybody. Enjoy the holidays. And I'll see you guys next Thursday for another all-new episode.
Podcast One has new shows on our new app. Check out all the cool features to help you explore our exciting new programming, like America's Lakers Podcast with Jay Moore, Sessions with Randy Jackson, So Random with Corinne Olympios, Attack Each Day, The Harbaugh's Podcast, Not Just Sports with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen, and Sound of Success, The Dick Enberg Podcast, as well as your old favorites like The Lady Gang, Steve Austin, Shaquille O'Neal, and Adam Carolla. Get the new Podcast One app in the App Store, Google Play, or podcast1.com.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.